your host for this hour of personal revolution, aimed at awakening the vision of America that nourishes the spirit within, connecting all of us and making sure we arrive at that destination. Now, you can call us toll-free to 888-228-4494 from the U.S. and Canada, or you can call us toll-free to 877-489-6350 worldwide. And you can call our direct line to 530-776-5154. In your local area, in your personal life, in every imaginable way, you're living on interlocking grids that suck you dry. You're working harder for less all the time. Just like that old hamster in the corporate cage whose efforts enrich only those we never really see except as images on television. Think about how it looks to the hamster, huh? It's ugly, it's intentional, and the first step in the revolution is losing your illusions. Here we give you the exits from the grid, but even better, you get the portal to community, serenity, prosperity, and truth. Just think about that for a minute, huh? There are negatives in life, and those are the things that we move away from. And then there are the good things we want. This show is about clearing out the bad so we can bring in the good things life offers when the grids grind to a halt. Off the Grids is a show you need everyone in your local area to hear so that you can organize for local liberty. We need to take back control at the local level, and that will be the real revolution, the one that never took place. So help us help you. Ask your local station to stream us into your local area. To do that, contact us at bbsradio.com. All past shows become available as soon as is humanly possible on the station archives. My blog site's titled How the Neocons Stole Freedom, and this week the story at the top is titled Will You Have Food to Eat Next Year? Now, that's a scary thought, but one we now need to look at. What we eat either nourishes us or fails to nourish us. Nourishment is not just about feeding your body, of course. You also need to think about nourishing your soul. Our guest today will be talking about things that do just that. Nourish us spiritually, nourish our communities, build relationships, and act with love. And now, first, a few small news items. This is something you should be looking for, and we'll be giving you more information on what you can do about it through the Iconoclast, the paper in Texas that slapped down George Bush in 2004 next week. Cast your minds back over recent months. Have you experienced a check or payment being run twice by your bank? Not that bounced because the money wasn't in there, but that the bank just reprocessed accidentally? If so, let us know at the Iconoclast. You're not alone. You're very much not alone. Millions of Americans share your pain at the bank robberies now going on through the Federal Reserve grid. You need to know, and you need to get in touch. And now, a note about Rudy Giuliani. At a recent rally for Rudy, the major media could find only one supporter who turned out for them to interview. Now, here's what one Ron Paul reporter had to say. This appeared on Lou Rockwell's site. The media could only find one Giuliani supporter, but that could not escape from the massive number of Ron Paul supporters. Apparently, they had to interview Giuliani's one supporter in a hallway. Could that have been to avoid showing an empty meeting room? Could that have been the only place without Ron Paul supporters? Giuliani checked into the hospital after the rally. They claimed it was for flu-like symptoms, but we think it was probably an emotional breakdown. Chagrin is in the air for more than the candidates. Here's an interesting report on Karl Rove. Karl Rove worried about Ron Paul. Momentum. Bush's brain fears bandwagon effect could trump national recognition in early Republican primaries. Sniff, sniff. This was on the Prison Planet on Thursday. Without mentioning his name, Karl Rove made it clear during a recent appearance on Hannity and Combs that he is worried about people jumping on a bandwagon and supporting a candidate who picks up momentum as a result of early Republican primaries being bunched together tightly. Since Rove had already discussed the other Republican candidates in the Fox News piece, he could only have been referring to Congressman Ron Paul. The man who was dubbed, quote, the architect and, quote, Bush's brain, told Hannity he was concerned that the thick and fast style of the early primaries would hinder Americans from making a, quote, more considered judgment, unquote, increasing the likelihood of a, quote, bandwagon effect overcoming, quote, national reputation. I wonder what he means by national reputation. And so the fat boy is about to sing, it looks like to me. And now an update on the Ron Paul campaign. From Zogby, Ron Paul will surprise you. Ron Paul, he's going to do better than anyone expects. Look to Paul to climb into the double digits in Iowa. Why? He's different. He stands out. He's against the war, and he has the one in four Republicans who oppose the war all to himself. Libertarianism is hot, especially among free market Republicans and 20-somethings, and he's an appealing sort of father figure. He's his own brand. All he needs to do is beat a couple of big names in Iowa. Then New Hampshire is friendlier territory. After all, the state motto is live free or die. The Tea Party in Boston on the 16th happened, and so did Money Bomb number 2. Linda Honeycutt, the granny warrior, and her cadre of Ron Paulites were on the ground for the party. The granny warrior and her four dedicated assistants left from North Carolina and drove in the granny mobile for 23 hours straight to arrive in Boston. On the way, even while in motion, they were converting truckers who had not yet heard about the Ron Paul revolution. Chris Moore, Don Curry, Jeremy Edmonds, and Dane Randall were all ready to take it on the road full-time for the revolution and, with Granny, march through Boston to rally, signing on the snow and letting the birthplace of revolution know that it is happening again. Be looking for their new adventure to start January 1st. Hear the announcement here or in Ron Paul Land, America. And in case you're the only one in America who doesn't know, the bomb raised over $6 million. And now a few thoughts for the week ahead. Last week we heard from both Paul Leto and Jim Condon on the subject of elections, why they should be run by the people. You need to know that there are strong indications that plans are afoot by the major parties to steal the coming primaries. That is why coming together, right and left, is so very important right now, and that's why Paul and Jim are talking. Poll watchers are needed in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. To get in touch and help, go to watchthevote2008.com. Remember, elections are the sole channel of power and taxing authority transfer from the sovereign, we the people, to our public servants. The government has no possible excuse for failure because it's their number one job to secure individual rights and self-government, as stated in paragraph 2 of the Declaration of Independence. The whole reason governments are created and instituted in the first place is to secure these rights. It's absolutely critical for any people who wish to be self-governing and thus free to monitor and control their own elections. Because it is so rife with immense conflicts of interest, the government can't do elections alone or with their chosen corporate contractor, because no person or government can credibly determine their own power unilaterally. You never let them run the ship. And that's from Paul Leto. Thanks, Paul. The solution is return to the original American vision, this time affirmed for all of us. Today's show is our last one before Christmas. Now, most people know that Christmas is not the birth date of the Son of God we know as Jesus. Early Christians placed the celebration there because they wanted to focus attention on a Christian celebration. Christmas is what we celebrate instead of winter solstice. Winter solstice is the date that marks the turn back of winter toward the renewal of spring. It is a moment in the life of Earth that our ancestors looked for when they were locked into what they viewed as a season of death. It is therefore entirely appropriate that we celebrate the advent of Jesus' time on earth on Christmas. He is the spiritual force that turned us from death to life. We live on the earth, living out the message of Christ, which is one that calls us to community, renewal, kindness, justice, and unmeasured love. That message resonates today in every part of our lives. As we confront the deceit, coercion, and violence of the government in bed with corporations, the more obvious it is to all of us that the vision of America, dreamed by men and women of faith and courage, has been hijacked for the profit of those who would appoint themselves our rulers. Last week we talked about why we need to take back control of our elections. This week we're going to talk about returning to community in ways that bypass politics, taking us straight to our relationship with Christ through those we touch with our lives and through how we nourish the bodies that God gave us. Being one means awareness with the well-being of others, how we steward the earth, reach out to our neighbors and friends, how we raise up our children to do right with their own lives. We can do that with every bite we eat, demonstrating love through things that nourish more than our stomachs. Our guest today is Joel Saladin, the second of three generations of farmers with a mission to make what we eat good for us and for the earth. Joel's farm, where those three generations work and live, is Polyface Farm in Virginia. And here's a quote from the Polyface website about Joel's book that says it best. Although Polyface Farm has been glowingly featured in countless national print and video media, it would not exist if the USDA and the Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services had their way. From a lifetime of noncompliance, frustration, humor, and passion come the behind-the-scenes real stories that have brought this little family farm into the forefront of the non-industrial food system. Asked recently where he thought America's food system was on the continuum of history, Joe Saladin responded, "We're at wounded knee." For all the foodie fluff and eco-local buzz, in the final analysis, the embedded heritage, transparent, truthful food system is in danger of annihilation. Seventh Cavalry wears blue pinstripe suits and sits in posh government office buildings. The Native Americans are farmers trying to heal their land, their neighbors, and their food. Joel used the stories in his book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. Joel is a little bit evangelist, but also a lover of the earth and humanity. Get his book and read it. He has a lot to say, a lot to share about the direction we need to take today. Back to community. Please welcome Joe Saladin. Joe, are you there?
I am, Melinda. Thank you very much.
Well, I am so glad you could be with us today to talk about something that really people need to be conscious of. I know it doesn't get the attention that it deserves because people go, oh, well, that's just food. But, I mean, if you need it to keep you alive, it's saying like, oh, that's just air, right? You better give it to me.
Well, you know, you start talking about the grid and, actually, we humans lived a long time without electricity. We lived a long time without computers. We lived a long time. Goodness, we could almost live without money, really.
Amen.
But it's pretty difficult to live without food.
You can't. And
that's right.
I think that's actually one of the same reasons that people just don't seem to want to acknowledge how important it is. Because if they acknowledge it, they have to confront it.
That's right. That's right. You can't escape it.
Yes. So we want to trivialize it and minimize it, and you can't. And I really believe what I said, that, you know, we have to understand that, you know, our relationship with food that we eat is a lot more significant than, you know, what we've tried to make it be. It really does matter. And, why don't we start? I'd like you to tell, you know, the listeners something about your background and about the history of the farm, because I think that the history is just fantastic.
Well, our family came here in 1961. I was just four when we came, and we arrived here from Venezuela, South America, where Dad and Mom had a farm for about a decade and lost it in the coup of Pérez Jiménez. And we were, you know, it was the beginning of the ugly American. We were not missionaries. We were not corporate. We were not, you know, diplomats. We were just American tent makers in a foreign country, living on the land and taking our chickens and stuff down to the market like all the indigenous folks, and inculcating ourselves into that culture. That's exactly what the plan was. And of course, you know, we got caught in the whole melee of the anarchy and the coup, and being American, of course, we were prime targets for the communist instigated rebels. And so, make a long story short, we exhausted every possible means we could there. Dad spent an extra half a year, visited every single ministry in Caracas, and every door closed. And so we left the country with the shirts on our back. He and Mom lost everything. They were in their early 40s and lost every penny they had, and returned to the U.S. and started over.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found this most worn out, eroded, grungy farm on the Mid-Atlantic region, and it was real cheap, and we bought it, and we've been in the healing process ever since. And we really ultimately, we see our whole ministry, our whole calling here as being in the healing business. That means healing, you know, healing the earthworms, healing the soil, healing the land, actually becoming husbandmen, as, you know, God intended in the Garden of Eden, to dress and keep it and leave it better than it was to begin with. And there are, you know, definite principles in order to do that. And, of course, most farming over the centuries has not done that. It's been more, rape-oriented, where every generation figures out how to turn what it took nature 1,000 years to create into cash.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is completely different. It's amazing that you say that, because that is so right on to what we need to be doing today. And you've been doing it for generations.
Yes, yes. We're now three generations. Mom's still alive, and so I'm second generation, and our son really runs the farm. And then we have two grandsons, so we actually have four generations now on the farm. Our grandsons are 4 and 2, and they're not driving tractors yet, but it won't be long.
It won't be long, right?
No, it won't be long.
And that's amazing. And so that's actually, this is a ministry for you then.
Oh, very much so, very much so. The whole, everything we do has to pass through has to meet the criteria of, is this healing? And so we're not about, you know, the USDA mantra, everything at the USDA runs through the goal of faster, bigger, fatter, cheaper. If it's faster, bigger, fatter, cheaper, then it's good. And there's no moral, ethical consequences to anything as long as it's faster, bigger, fatter, cheaper. And at our farm, we believe that we humans are capable of creating and innovating things beyond our ability to spiritually, emotionally, physically, or morally metabolize.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't have some sort of a moral, ethical value system as a boundary fence, if you will, around what we can innovate, we will innovate things that, will be Pandora's box.
They'll destroy
it. We can't put it back in. And so, that's where we are. We want to have those kind. We want to ask questions like, are the pigs able to express their pigness?
That's a great question.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the USDA never asked that. The USDA asks, can we grow it faster? Can we grow it bigger? Can we grow it cheaper? Can we have more of them on less space? I mean, every question is asked in the book except, how does the pig express its pigness? And yet, that is such a fundamental question, because it is the philosophical cornerstone that lays the moral foundation for how we view life. A culture which views pigs and chickens and tomatoes and pepper plants.
So would you say that it's fair to say that you want people to live consciously in every part of their lives, and especially spiritually consciously?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, "Whithersoever therefore ye eat or drink or whatsoever ye do, do half of it to the glory of God." No, it says do all to the glory of God. And what's more common than eating and drinking? You know, if I had been writing that, I would have said, you know, whithersoever you catechize the second, you know, book of doctrine, or, you know, I would make it some sort of very highfalutin, you know, spiritual thing. But in the New Testament, Paul, in his writing, he simply uses the most mundane things of life, you know, eating and drinking, to express the depth and the width and the height and the breadth of what we're supposed to bring under the purview of a moral, ethical conscience. And so my point is that a culture that simply views chickens and pigs and tomatoes as an inanimate pile of protoplasmic structure to be manipulated however the human mind can conceive to manipulate it, will probably view Melinda and Tom and Jane and Mary from the same egocentric manipulative standpoint.
And that's exactly what the corporations do, of course.
Yes, exactly.
You know, they don't want to give us our pigness.
That's right. That's right. And even other cultures. I mean, we view other cultures with that same type of manipulative idea. And it's a very, you know, it's a very arrogant, egocentric way to view the world, to view life, view our neighbors, all of these things. The point is that how we sit down and commune with that plate before us.
Well, and that's exactly what you're talking about here. You're talking about being much more spiritually conscious and aware, and actually making every time you eat or drink an act of communion.
Yes, that's correct. That it is indeed a moral act. Now, I'm not trying to tell everybody, you know, you can never have a Snickers bar. Okay, I like one once in a while too, but there's a difference between, you know, having one once a month and having, you know, three Diet Cokes a day. There's a big difference. And so, you know, the idea is that we should be, at the end of the week, we should look back at the end of the week and say, okay, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day and it didn't destroy in a day, and I'm not going to change my life in a day, but at the end of this week, can I look back and say which side, the healing side or the exploitive side, the nurturing side or the conquistador side, which side was encouraged and gained momentum as a result of the way I chose to eat this week?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question each of us can ask and actually have an impact on very viscerally every week.
And another thing you do on your site, and this makes perfect sense as an extrapolation, you talk about the earthworm. So obviously what you're talking about here is taking a look at the total, the whole of Earth, and the whole of our relationship with all parts of the Earth.
Yes.
Right?
Well, that's right. That's right. We don't want to have something. For example, if we can grow more corn, for example, but it makes the soil dead in doing so and makes nutritionally deficient corn, that's not a very noble task, a very noble calling.
No, it isn't. But it goes very much along with the whole corporate model. I mean, the whole corporate paradigm is only to generate income, nothing else.
Well, that's right. And yet you and I both know, and I'm sure all of our listeners know, intuitively, we all place more value on things that never find their way on a balance sheet than things that do. What, mm-hmm. you know, what millionaire wouldn't give it all to have the respect and honor of his wife and his kids?
You know, they do. They spend a lot of money getting it after they earn it in very bad ways.
Yeah, but most of a lot of times it's a charade. My point is that you and I know that the most valuable things in life, you know, love and faithfulness and loyalty and goodness, you know, frogs with legs and clean rain and clean rivers and dancing earthworms, you know, these are all things that never see a Wall Street balance sheet.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And yet intuitively in our deep in our spirit we all know that it's more important that the earthworms continue giving us fertile soil than that Wall Street have a blue chip day.
Well, and yes, and the earthworms are more real than any corporation because they are alive.
Well, yeah, that's true. I'm just trying to explain value, just you know, relative
yes.
value.
Would you say that one of the things we're looking at is a balance sheet for things of the spirit, that we need to be very conscious of those, that we perhaps need to have accountants who, or just be our own accountant for the things that we do every day that bring that world into existence very consciously for us as individuals and as communities?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't begin to describe this for every single person, but I can tell you that there are a lot of things about industrial farming that are extremely damaging to the earth, to all of us. I mean, for one thing, let's take a really prime example. Let's take bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mad cow.
Yes.
I mean, mad cow came supposedly as a result of feeding herbivores meat. You know, dead cow.
Which is a horrifying thought. They actually were feeding cows to cows.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, you got to understand that for 40 years, the USDA, I call it the USDA, was
well said.
Was whining and dining farmers like me on steak dinners to teach us this new scientific method of feeding cows. We're going to feed them cheaper and faster and bigger with feeding, you know, feeding dead cows to cows. And this was a new scientific method. Well, I didn't buy it because I looked at it and said, wait a minute, cows are herbivores. Herbivores don't eat meat. I mean, that is God's design. So I did not go down that road. But here we are 40 years later, and this huge collective oops is coming up, and it was given to us because there was no respect and honor of the cowness of the cow. That's why it's so important. So what do we have now? We have mad cow. Well, in order to control mad cow, what do we have to do? We have to microchip every cow with a radio frequency identification
device. Now that's just plain wrong.
Well, of course it's wrong. And in fact, we now, you don't own your cows. I don't own my cows. My cows are simply part of the national herd. Have you heard them talking about the national herd, the national flock? So now, you know, I'm supposed to register my farm with the government and tell them how many cows I have, microchip every cow, so they can monitor these cows, know where they are. I'm supposed to notify them by computer every time I move one from, you know, from one farm to another. And
one pasture to another?
No, not one pasture, but one, you know, one farm, one property. If you rent farms or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you take one to a vet, or if you take one to the slaughterhouse or whatever. The point is that it starts so sincerely. Let's see if we can grow these cows cheaper. And it's I'm all about economies of scale. That's fine. But as soon as it adulterates the basic inherent design of that herbivore, then suddenly you head down a slippery slope that requires technological fixes, corporate fixes, corporate fixes, corporate fixes, until finally, you know, all the little producers are run out of business because the RFID technology is so onerous that small producers can't afford it, can't afford the scanners, can't afford the paperwork, can't afford the computers, and so now we have additional centralization, more industrialization, the small get squeezed out, the big get bigger, and, you know, it's the that's the way it goes.
And the whole time they haven't looked at whether or not people are actually doing better and are healthier even, which would seem to be pretty minimal to me.
Oh, whether the food is nutritional, that doesn't matter at all. That doesn't matter at all.
And that's, of course, one of the frightening things. I mean, what do they think is going to happen? Of course, that does then move us into a much better profit position for Big Pharma.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, the whole key to controlling the power and the strength of the corporate food system is competition from the bottom up. And of course, that is what they fear more than anything. I mean, I've been called a bioterrorist by the poultry industry because our chickens that are out on pasture commiserate with red-winged blackbirds and carry our viruses and diseases to the scientifically sound Tyson, you know, fecal concentration camp chicken houses. And, you know, the real problem here is that the nice little, you know, evangelical Christians who go down to the pro-life rallies stop off at McDonald's for Happy Meals to eat the corporate chickens that the environmentalists understand are dishonored, disrespected, and then the Christians wonder, well, why aren't these people listening to me? Why do I have no credibility? And
because they're not living consistently.
That's right, because they're not living consistently. And for Christians who view, for example, an environmentalist who would rather who has no trouble hugging a tree, but ripping out an 8.5-month-old human baby that, you know, can distinguish between two voices and wiggles and responds to music and all the things that, of course, you know, babies do before they're born. You know, we look at that and say, how in the world can somebody, you know, save the tree and kill the baby? You know, we view that as just, I mean, unspeakably inconsistent. And mm-hmm. I can tell you, because I'm a, you know, Christian libertarian environmentalist capitalist,
I like the combination. It's good.
that when I go and speak at a seminar and they call me an organic farmer, they're expecting, of course, you know, this very environmentally liberal, endorse everything that the National Education Association wants, and to say that, we all need to pay more taxes and, you know, all these things. They find it amazing that I come from a more conservative libertarian Judeo-Christian worldview, and yet that I have this amazing respect and honor for the earth. It's too bad. It's really too bad that the Christian community allowed the environmentalist crowd who worships the creation rather than the creator, allowed that crowd to take this high moral road that we should be, you know, that we should be known for.
Well, you know why that happened? It happened because of the manipulation of people like Karl Rove. I mean, the fact that they split us like that, I don't know if you remember back in the late 60s, 1970, there wasn't any division there. It didn't exist. They had to
right.
create it.
Right.
And that was so that they could control us, because if they control us right and left, then, you know, because we're divided, then how can we all get on the same page? But you're absolutely correct. There isn't any real conflict there whatsoever. We should all be on the same page.
Yes. Yeah.
Because
it isn't
how you arrive. We're all going the same place.
Right. Well, and that is why I've put so much attention on trying to increase awareness of the potential social economic healing aspects of local food systems, local food purchasing, local food production, local food selling, because ultimately the answers are not going to come from the top. They're going to come with you and me and thousands like us opting out of Walmart, opting out of McDonald's, and finding our local food source. And that's where the ultimate sustainability, transparency, and food security is. Food security does not come from inside the Beltway. Food security comes when you know your food source and you have a relationship with it and you have a pantry full of canned goods and you have built a transparency and integrity train in your food system.
Mm-hmm. And you can see how that would be, because that then sends a resonant message. Because, I mean, we really are spiritual beings in bodies. And if we don't live that out, then we will have inconsistencies in our lives that trip us up.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I wanted to ask you a question. One of the things that I haven't, of course, finished reading the book yet, but I'm going to, that you talk about is our relationship with the animals, because there's been a tremendous conflict back and forth with people being vegetarians, not wanting to kill animals, but you don't do that. You raise the animals are killed, and then they're eaten. But if you let a pig have his pigness, then obviously, you know, you're living in a very compassionate way. You're using the animal by respecting what it is. So,
well, yes. I think the fact that we just deal with the animal rights issue for a moment, that a pig is a fly, is a person, is a dog, you know, that whole idea, the
mm-hmm.
sentient being idea. Look, that idea is not one that comes from a person who has reached a higher moral plane, you know, evolved to a higher spiritual level. It comes from a person whose only contact with animals is as pets. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this whole notion in our culture today that the only animal-human contact, the only context that contact happens in is with, you know, domestic pets, creates an incredibly jaundiced view of the historical relationship between animals and humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a person starts down this road that, you know, a dog is a fly, is a cow, is a person, I don't view that as, oh, suddenly they've gotten this higher, you know, higher moral sphere than me. You know, I'm just a bloodthirsty slaughterer, but rather poor them that they have so divorced themselves from the natural world, from the living world that humans have been a part of for a long, long time, that they would become so
disconnected?
Well, it's beyond disconnected. Unreasonable, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, again, I don't go around and tell vegetarians they should stop. I don't picket, you know, PETA and all that. If they don't, you know, that stands for, you know, people eating tasty animals. But you know, they can have that if they want to. But a lot of the things that they say, or most of it, stems from the fact that they have not been around animals. They haven't grown up with them, and so it speaks to our divorce of the normal human relationships rather than an attainment to a new, you know, to some new new moral high ground.
Mm-hmm. And you see that a lot. Most of the people who have that view definitely are the kind of people who are very much at a disconnect. They tend to be urban dwellers. They haven't had any experience with it, and they've never killed an animal.
Right.
They've never eaten an animal that they killed.
Not
even a fish.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so and then of course what fuels that, you know, the if we could move to the flip side of that, then that what fuels that, of course, is the rampant abuse and disrespect that industrial agriculture has. You know, when they stack 100,000, you know, egg chicken layers in one house, in nine chickens in a 16-inch by 22-inch cage. Now, 16, you know, take your hands. 16
That's like
inches
torture.
By 22 inches. They got nine birds in there for their whole life. Of course, they cut their claws off, cut their beaks off, so they don't kill each other. And they're crammed in a stench that is so bad it makes you nauseous when you just open the door. And these birds live in that all the time. That horror is what fuels the animal rights movement. Had we all been raising these animals with the respect and honor that we try to show, there would have never been enough wind to furl the sails of the animal rights movement. And so,
and doesn't it seem to you, and it's because it's always seemed to me as if this was almost artificially created as another way to divide us.
You mean the whole animal rights movement?
Yes, you have, you know, because it's so extreme and sort of insane in some ways, that and the fact that they have divided us on this, you know, very real issue about the way animals can be abused, you know, keeps us from getting together and agreeing that, no, we don't want factory farms. We want farms to be this way because it's humane, and it helps the pig have his pigness.
Well, I guess where I am on that, probably the most poignant story I know was I was up at the University of Guelph in Canada a couple years ago doing a seminar, and they had three of us on this panel in this town hall meeting at the University of Guelph, and I sat down, and then the guy next to me sat down, and he had a Bible with him in front of us. Oh, this will be interesting. This is unusual. And then there was a lady in the group, in the three of us, and we each were supposed to give our, you know, opening 5-minute pre-ramble, you know, and then it's going to be opened up for 2 hours of questions. Well, this guy next to me stood up in his 5 minutes. He took that Bible, he held it up, and this was the way he started out now with these, you know, hundreds of college students. He said, "I want you to understand that every single gully, every single piece of assault against the earth, assault against the animals, assault against plants, everything that is bad is because of this book." And his point was that here we are as, you know, as conservative, you know, Christians, or at least Judeo-Christian, you know, Judeo-Christian ethic type people.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of taking this high moral road, we try to get our kids educated enough so we're really proud of them when they land a job with Monsanto and Ciba Geigy and Merck Pharmaceuticals and invent more, you know, drugs from the devil's pantry to manipulate and further destroy the genetic code, the genetic the whole genetic design.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Christian community, you know, we just think this is wonderful when our kids go off and land these really wonderful jobs in these big corporate places to do very creative, innovative work. And, you know, I'm all for innovation and creative work. That's for sure. But, there's a whole lot of innovation and creative work that is...
Well, they thought of it in Nazi Germany, too.
That's right. There's nothing.
And we see a lot of that with the pesticide companies because, of course, they started as mm-hmm. companies that were producing weapons of war.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, we're still basically, spreading the stockpiles of World War II, onto our food. I mean,
that's kind of where we are.
It's such a horrifying thought, isn't it? It's like... isn't it silly that something like food that's so important for life should have to be powdered and pampered with all sorts of substances that end in C-I-D-E, which is the mm-hmm. Greek suffix for, or Latin suffix for death.
Yes. So, this is what you do. Your farm produces food. It gets delivered to central metropolitan points, and then people pick it up. You supply food to local restaurants so people know that they're eating healthy and they can feel better about themselves and about what they're doing with their families. But this is a growing movement. This is a movement where people are looking at all of these different issues, right?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. The fact is, just like the homeschooling movement was fueled once the public schools became so atrocious that people reached the stomach turning point. I mean, that's the way historical movements start. The pendulum has to swing so far in the wrong direction to get enough of the critical mass of people to reach the stomach turning point in order for it to stop back. You know, very few people get all excited when the pendulum is only, 5 degrees off center. But when it gets to about 90 degrees off center, then people start doing new things. And things like homeschooling, things like going to an acupuncturist instead of a medical doctor. Really radical, strange things like eating from a local farmer instead of, down at Walmart. And so as the pendulum moves in the food system, what's driving this is not so much suddenly people are wanting to eat wholly. People are fleeing from China, from avian flu, from E. coli, salmonella, campylobacter, all these little Latin words that we all now say that anybody over 40 doesn't even remember when they were growing up, and nobody even heard those words. Suddenly now we're saying them all the time. And those words are nature speaking to us, saying, enough, you've abused us enough. And the question is, will we listen? And more people are listening, beginning to connect those dots and realizing, wow, maybe 10,000 pigs in a confinement house on a slatted floor is too many pigs in one place at one time. Maybe that's why we're suddenly getting all of these strange diseases. And so nature always bats last, and God has the final word, and when we abuse the design enough, there is corrective action, whether we like it or not. as we try to get a handle on where the food system is, the fact is that the movement has gone so far off of what was designed, what was intended, that it's going to take very radical radical responses on the parts of both farmers. For example, that's why we raise our cows without any grain, just on grass, because then they don't get E. coli. They don't have those kinds of things in their gut. And we have the chickens out on grass. You know, Britain has just done a study showing that chickens that eat a lot of chlorophyll don't get avian influenza. So, you know, there are really specific things that can be done, and we just need to join that, join that movement, or, you know, join the group, whatever that fraternity is. We know there's a fraternity of industrial everything on the grid, and there's also a fraternity of people that are promoting and doing these other things, and we just need to ferret those out, find them, and patronize them, and encourage this fraternity. So what kind of production, you know, does really respect and honor the cowness of the cow, or the pigness of the pig, or the chickenness of the chicken, the tomatoness of the tomato? Well, it requires, first of all, honoring and respecting the soil life, and the whole food web. You know, there's a whole community of critters in that soil. You know, there are billions of microorganisms in every handful of healthy soil. And they've never heard of the religious right or the liberal left or, you know, Hillary or, you know, Barack or Rudy Giuliani or anybody, okay? And so the question is, how do we care for them? Well, we care for them with the kind of food that they want to eat, which is, you know, decomposed, lignified, carbonaceous material, and, compost and biomass that all runs on solar energy. You know, this doesn't take heavy energy from outside. And then the other community that's very personal is the 3 trillion intestinal microflora and fauna that lives inside of us, in our intestines. And, this is not dirty. This is what sustains us, that bacteria. And so how do we feed them? Well, pretty much anything that was around before 1900 is okay. If it developed after 1900, when it started becoming amalgamated, extruded, adulterated, and reprocessed and hydrogenated and everything else, it probably shouldn't be eaten. And so what we want is to appreciate and identify the indigenous heritage community that lives within us, under us, and around us, and have our food system that that respects and honors that particular type of community life. And if we honor that microscopic community, if you will, based on our honoring of the spiritual or a non-physical community based on that value system, we give that to the microscopic community, guess what? It builds the community that we can see, our neighbors, relatives, friends. It builds a fraternity network that then becomes food security trust and food integrity for ourselves. So suddenly, we don't have 1,500 miles between producer and plate. Suddenly, we don't have to put so many tractor trailers on the interstate because the food is being produced in our, you know, in our backyard, so to speak. We don't have to worry about the supermarket shelves being empty because we know our farmer down the road, and we know the cows are in his field, and we know he knows us by name. And so we develop this more insular, secure relationship and community that that allows us to transfer our faith from government policy and move that faith to something closer, more within our control, something we can do something about, as opposed to something that's completely whimsical and outside of our control. So, you know, these things are very interconnected, intertwined, and it's wonderful to be a part of that type of macro healing process.